this angle okay?
Yeah, that's
okay.
Fine.
I'm really pleased to be able to introduce our presenter tonight, who many of you know already, Dan Mortensen. Dan is the president of Dan Sound Incorporated. Dan is a specialist in live sound reinforcement. So why is he going to be talking to us about studios? I'll leave that question.
Good question.
Him. Dan, as I mentioned, is the section chair of the Pacific Northwest AES section. He served for more than 25 years as a committee member and or officer. And he is in the start of his eighth term as a section chair. In his free time, Dan enjoys researching the 30th Street Recording Studio. And without further ado, Dan, take it away.
Thank you. So first of all, thanks for coming here. It's really an honor to be presenting this subject to you that I've been really into for quite a while now. I wanted to give you some background before we start the official presentation. This is going to be given in the New York Convention next month, and you guys are my guinea pigs for this presentation, and I welcome comments and suggestions and critiques later when we get passed through the presentation. I sincerely want to know how this thing was. This slide here is the studio building, 30th Street Studio, which was at 207 East 30th Street. And it's a really strange-looking structure. The two outboard sides of it are chopped off, it looks like. It looks like there were some windows or something there, and they're kind of strangely done. And there's a bunch of blank windows on the bottom floor and that white stuff. And it's really strange. And Greg, this is the time to start. Thank you. So before we start, I think I know the answer to this question, but was anybody there at the 30th Street Studio? Was anybody, I'll get to that question later. You should feel free to ask questions about what we're looking at any given moment, but save any general questions like, what's my favorite record or something, till the end, okay? And I'll do my best to answer that kind of stuff. We're going to go back to a time before cell phones and cameras, and I respectfully request that you not take pictures after a certain point in the presentation, and I'll make it clear where that point is. There's a bunch of... I've worked really hard on this, and there's a bunch of stuff that I'm not ready to see on the internet yet, and there's other people who have been part of this, and I'll show you late in a little bit a thread that I have going where people post stuff. And there was a studio drawing that a guy did on graph paper of the thing, and I was looking on the internet for something and came across somebody's website, and they had that drawing on their website, totally unrelated to whatever it was they were doing, but stuff gets out. So again, you can take whatever pictures you want for a while here if you want to, but I'll tell you when not to. And if somebody comes in late, I would appreciate it if you would ask them to not take pictures also if I'm not paying attention. Okay, so the other thing is this is going to be about 75 minutes long. I've got an hour and a half slot at the convention, and I need to go from beginning to end. And we have some waters here, and if you want to raise your hand, Greg will come around and give you a water. Is that a reasonable thing to do? So now would be a good time if you're going to want any water in the next 75 minutes. Please go ahead and do that. So you started the timer already, right? Oh, and if you have questions, please go to the microphones here. Rick is recording it, and we'll get your question on the microphone, and that would be awesome. So here's what we're going to cover today. First, like Greg said, how do I know what I'm going to show you? Then we're going to look at the eras in the studio building's history, and those are divided up roughly from 1875 to 1946, which is the pre-studio time. 46 or so to 49, the conversion to the studio and the early operation as a studio. 49 to 56, the old control room and tape era. 56 to 62, the leave it alone time. If you were at any of Frank's meetings, you heard about that. And I think it's really this six-year period that that applied to, not its entire life. And I'll show you why I think that. Then from 62 to about 71, the new control room and a new mixer. From 71 to 81, a mixer with sliding faders, digital recording, and then its ultimate demolition. So first, how do I know these things? It all starts with here with Frank Laco, who, was anybody at Frank Laco meetings? Brett, raise your hand, please. So you know who he was and who I'm talking about. He was just an amazing guy who was, coincidentally, his recording career with CBS, with Columbia, pretty much was the duration of the studio's lifetime. He was hired there in about 46, 47, and retired in 82. And the studio went from, again, from 48 roughly to 81. And I think all of you will agree that he was really amazing to hear and listen to. And I've told this story a lot of times, and I'll tell it again. Is the Bob Smith amazingly brought him, found him. I think Kevin Jablonski found him, but you figured out that you lived near him and started bringing him to our meetings. And I would sit near you and him and talk about stuff, and he would talk about things that he had done. And go, oh, that's pretty cool. And then we had this meeting in West Seattle at the in front of the Easy Street shop where Jeffrey Bruton's recording truck. And only three people could go into it at a time to listen and see what the truck was like. And it just happened to be me and Bob and Frank in there. And Bob had gone into Easy Street and bought some Miles Davis records, CDs. And Jeffrey said, you want to hear something? And Bob said, yeah, I want to play Miles Davis. So he put on the Miles Davis, and Frank started talking, while Miles was playing, Frank started talking about what Miles was thinking about when he was recording that and what was going on in the studio. And I'm telling you, I just about fell over, and my head went into the speaker and body went into the speaker, and I was there in the studio with Miles while Frank is talking about this. And I thought, holy crap, this is amazing. We've got to have more meetings with Frank. So Bob and I, there was one meeting early on that I wasn't able to go to, and then there was not a plan to do another one. So Bob and I decided we were going to do meetings with Frank, and we started meeting with him because I don't know anything about recording stuff. And we started meeting with Frank so that I could find out what he did and what was going on and how he did it. And we would go up to his place in Edmonds every week for about 2 or 3 months before the December 2008 meeting so that we and I could figure out what to talk about at his meeting. And his career was just astonishing, as you know now, and the people that he worked with was incredible, and I'm going to show you some of that as we go. Ben, yes?
One question. Were you at the initial meeting?
I was not at the initial meeting, but I heard it on audio, and I thought, God, this is really great. So it's incredible. Yeah, yeah. It is that he can't happen to move out here to be with near their daughter. So this is Frank at in the 30th Street studio. He's up in the control room, and that's the control window that he's sitting in front of, control room window that he's sitting in front of. And when I saw this picture, I always wondered, this was right after it was converted into a studio. So this is essentially state of the art of the time. And I look at this picture and I thought, why were they using recycled lumber for the trim there? And I could never figure it out, but I found the answer and I'm going to share it with you later. So remember that mortise. But that's Frank as a young man. Here he is later. This is a show with him and his wife. And unfortunately, his wife was supposed to come tonight, but she tore a ligament in her leg or someplace and couldn't be here with us. But that's Bob and Deborah behind them, and they came to a concert that I did, and it was really great to get to know him. Bob and I did about 6 or maybe 8 meetings with Frank, And this is the last one that we did. This is after he had his stroke, and this was in his rehab center, and they've very generously decided to do it. And I haven't posted this video at all yet, and I don't know that I will, because when I look at it, it looks like we're torturing him and killing him, because he was in a wheelchair, if you can tell that, and he was in pretty tough shape. But his wife and the caregivers agreed that the meetings that we did with them always perked him up. When we would talk with him and he would do a meeting, it was like he was 20 years younger every single time. And I went by the day after this meeting to say hello and to thank him for that. And they were sitting in the courtyard in the sun. It was a beautiful day like today. And he looked like he was in Hollywood, and oh yeah, all day people have just been making me sign autographs and stuff. And it was amazing. It was the change in him from before that to this was remarkable. And this was June of, I think, 2012, and then he passed away in April of 2013. So it was really amazing that we got to be with him. And he won the honorary member award from the Audio Engineering Society, which is more than, when I applied for it for him, I thought it was just free membership, but it's the highest award that the Audio Engineering Society gives for non-members. And other people who have won it are people like Walt Disney and Leonard Bernstein, and a bunch of really heavy-duty Harry Olson technical people. The list of honorees is remarkable, and I've posted it at several places online. So that's how this all started. For me, was getting to know the studio through Frank and wanting to know more about it. Another person that you should know about is this guy, and his name is Fred Plaut, and he was Frank's co or superior engineer. He was the chief engineer for CBS for a long time, for Columbia. And Fred and Frank they were the top guys at that time, and then there were apprentices and other people around. But Fred did most of the Broadway shows, most of the classical stuff. He did the Miles Davis Kind of Blue and Sketches of Spain and a bunch of others, and the Take Five, Dave Brubeck, and he was also a photographer and would take his camera with him to work and take pictures of people. And he wound up leaving something like 30 or 40,000 images in his legacy. He and his wife, Rose, didn't have any kids. So they left it to Yale University, which is where he taught after he left Columbia. He retired from Columbia in about 72. And I went and visited the archive at Yale one day, one year, for about 2 hours, where I got 932 pictures of the contact sheets. So a 35 millimeter frame is about 3/4 of an inch by an inch or something. And I got 900 and some of those in 2 hours. And that totally changed what I understood about the studio up until that point. The pictures were just, they weren't good quality because I'm taking shitty little pictures of these little things. But the information in it was just remarkable. And I'll show you some of that as we get forward here. Then I went again a year later for 5 days and took pictures of the negatives, and then reversed those, and those were much better. They're still not scans, but they are much better than the other ones. And I got about 8,000 of those. He was really a remarkable photographer and really opened up that time and place so that we can see it, which I think is what blows me out, is that he did all of this and we get to benefit from it. So that's something. There's an index to it that you can look through if you want, and it focuses on famous people, and there's nothing whatsoever about technical people or no IDs of them or anything. So that's one thing that I've been doing, is identifying that kind of stuff. So I need to have you read this part starting at MSS 52, and that needs to be every time I use these pictures or show them. I need to credit the Yale Library, and they were really great people. The last part about Richard and Emily was for me because they were super helpful while I was there for that week. Also, I've been through the Sony and CBS archives in New York City. I've been there a total of 9 days in the last 2 years. And they've been extremely generous in letting me go through stuff. And I've gathered several thousand, at least, pages of information from there. I've also went to the New York City Department of Buildings and went through all of the construction stuff for 207 East 30th for its entire history. So that's how I know some of this stuff. There's a really great database by the former Music Librarian of Congress, Michael Gray, who has responded to my efforts. And he sent me this link and a bunch of other stuff too. But you can go to this www.classical-discography.org and search it for classical stuff. That's all he was interested in. So there's no pop stuff there. But you can sort by studio and by year and by whatever and see all kinds of stuff. And then almost lastly, Don Hunstein was the staff photographer for CBS Columbia and would get sent out to do projects for publicity purposes. So the photo on the cover of the Bob Dylan album with him and Suze Rotolo walking through the snow on 4th Street, that's a Don Hunstein photograph. And you can also see him in the Glenn Gould On the Record CBC documentary, where he comes in with a camera around his neck and Glenn's playing and he goes click, click, and Glenn says, oh, that's enough. And Don says, oh yeah, I'm done. So that's, you know, literally two pictures. But he was a remarkable person. And I got to meet him a couple of years ago at the first meeting that I had of the group I'm gonna talk to him about in a minute here. And I wanna plug this book of his. He died in March. And this is a book that came out right about 2 or 4 years ago, I guess, called Keeping Time. And John Pareles wrote the text, and a guy named Leo Sachs did some editing. And Art Garfunkel wrote a foreword. And there's a lot of pictures of 30th Street in it. It's not all 30th Street. There's a lot of other places, too. Don was buddies with Johnny Cash, and there's pictures of Johnny Cash down on his farm in Arkansas or wherever it is. And it's really a fascinating book. It's a big coffee table thing, and you can get it used on Amazon for about $20, and it's a pretty sweet book. Lastly, the source of a lot of the information that I'm finding is this Steve Hoffman forums. I have a thread on there, which I will refer to in this talk as the thread, as a source of information. And this is the first post on this page. If you Google the history of CBS Records 30th Street Studio, this will be the first or second hit. We're up to 72 pages now and about 1,500 posts, and it's over 100,000 views. Page views of this stuff. And this is an amazing forum that I've mentioned before at our meetings, where there are 24 hours a day, there's 400 or 500 people from around the world arguing about which pressing of which this album sounds the best, or what 10 albums would they like to take to their desert island, or what is the best classical violinist or whatever. And they are remarkably knowledgeable about stuff, and there were so many things recorded in CBS in the 30th Street Studio: Broadway shows, opera type stuff, lots of classical stuff, pop stuff, jazz. And people there know all about stuff and have gigantic record collections. So when we were first going through this, we're trying to figure out what Broadway shows were recorded there. And a guy said, well, let me go through my collection. I'll look on the backs and see what they are. And he comes back about 3 days later with a list of 50 albums that were recorded in 30th Street. And you know, he's got to have thousands of albums to be able to do that. And it's like, geez, you know, this is really something. And I've been posting pictures on there of people that I don't know from the Plout collection who are pictured in it. And people can identify that stuff. There's a guy who lives around here, Matt Lutens, who's come to some of our meetings, and I hoped would come, but he had to work tonight. And he can find all of that stuff, and you'll see that if you go here. It's free to read this. You if you want to post it on there, you have to be a free member. It's all free if you want to. You can donate too, but it's there. And the last thing is a group that I founded at that last meeting with Frank called the Friends of the 30th Street Studio. And I've had a meeting there. I think this last one was my fourth Friends of 30th Street meeting in New York. We meet at this mastering studio in Chelsea that remasters all the old Sony stuff. And they've been real supportive of this. And a lot of people who worked there come to these meetings and talk about their experiences there. And I've been trying to figure out what to do with all of this stuff that I've got collected. And my neighbor across the street, I was describing this to him, and I'd like to do a database of all of this stuff so that you can find who were all of the guitar players who were at 30th Street or whatever. And he was a database specialist for Starbucks and Washington Mutual before he retired, and a jazz fan. And he went ahead and did the back end of a relational database, which is how all this stuff is stored and how it relates to each other. And it's done. But he doesn't know anything about the front end, which is entering the data and searching for it and doing that. And we need to find somebody to do that. And if there's any students who are interested in doing that, or people who want to spend some time doing, apparently a web designer can do that stuff. And that's as much as I know about it. I hope he was going to come tonight, but he didn't make it. So anyway, talk to me afterwards if you are interested in that, if what I'm going to show you strikes you as cool as it strikes me. So before we move on, we need to talk about the most important component of a studio, because we're going to talk about the architecture and the tools that they used and everything. But what is that component? It's the people in it who made it work. And one of the reasons that I'm doing this project is to honor both the work these people did, but also make it known that they were the ones who did it. I want to honor their names and their works. So the jobs of the people involved with the studio were the recording engineers, who back in the day were called control men, because they were at the controls, I guess. The tape operators, who stand at the tape recorder and fast forward to 1 minute 33 and rewind or do whatever and load the tapes and everything. The studio assistants, who move all of the stuff around out in the studio as necessary. The technical maintenance staff. CBS, Columbia designed and built their own consoles, and not only did they make them, but they made sure that they kept working. And that's real important. When you're in a studio, you need to have the stuff working when you want it to. So that's a big deal. The producers, who work with the artists to polish the songs to make them the way they should be. The arrangers and musical directors, who work under the producers to get that stuff together. The editors and mixers, who take the tapes that are made by the control men and edit them down or mix them together as necessary. The mastering engineers, who take that work, which is often sounds different from one unit to another, and blend it all together so you listen to an album and it sounds like it's a coherent entity. The librarians and storage staff, who take the big reels of tape and keep them someplace and bring them back when it's necessary to edit later again. And last but certainly not least is the artists, which in number are like, this is like an upside down pyramid. There's so many artists, literally thousands of people who went through 30th Street over the years. So this list here is why I made that ridiculous video that you might have watched a little bit of while you were walking in, of all of those names and their jobs and what they did, is to try to give an idea of what an overwhelming task it is to come to grips to all of these people who were involved in this thing. And that was the best way that I could figure to put all of that in a very short time frame. What you saw was 7 minutes of non-repeating names repeated twice and a half or a quarter or something. And I, for the artists, I went through 2 days of orchestra sessions for one part of it, and another, the other part of it was famous people that I saw around for the artist section. And that was just a fraction. And I left out stuff, I know, and I misspelled some stuff, I know. But that was over 1,000 things that you saw in that 7 minutes. So there's going to be mistakes. So I wanted to preserve those people and their contributions to a magical place at a magical time. And in reality, the, just like any other human endeavor where there's lots of people working, there were people pissed off at their coworkers, at their boss, or something was happening that was unhappy. And it's interesting talking to the people. The emotions are still pretty raw in some cases about things that happened 30 and 40 and 50 years ago. But I kind of prefer to focus on the beauty and artistry of what they came up with. So let's go to the eras of the studio, from the during the pre-studio to the transformation time. And first, where was it located? So here's a little map of Midtown Manhattan. North is at the top, more or less. The island is at an angle. So this should move here. But of course it's not. God dang it. This is an animation. There we go. Okay, so zooming in on it, we see the Javits Center on the left, and then across town on the right is 207 East 30th, between 30th and 31st, and 2nd Avenue and 3rd Avenue. And if we look at the end of this block, we see this, which is a 1906 map that I found, an atlas. We're going to ignore the 3rd Avenue Theater, which is right up there, which is pretty cool. Anyway, we're going to zoom in on the Adams Memorial Presbyterian Church, because that's the building that turned into the studio. You can see down at the bottom there's some towers on each side. There's a 23 by 20 foot skylight in the middle of the back. You can see the corners. What are these corners cut off on the back part? And those are heights there. The towers are 90 feet high each, and the roof is about 54 to 60 feet tall. So in 1875, this was built by the Madison Square Presbyterian Church to be the chapel for their mission house in the insufficiently churched Gas House District. And I don't understand why it's called the Gas House District, first of all. I haven't been able to find that out. Secondly, I don't understand why they thought it was insufficiently churched, because there's churches all over the place, but maybe not enough Presbyterian churches. I don't know. Yeah. So it was the Adams Memorial Church after the first pastor, who was Reverend Adams. This is the earliest picture I've been able to find, and this is pretty cool because it was sent to me from a resident right across the street from where it used to be, and he wasn't there at the time, but he had this picture from the King's Handbook in 1892. It had a stone foundation with brick walls 16 inches thick. The first floor, the floor beams were 3 inches by 12 inches on 12-inch centers, which was supported by 8 by 12 Georgia pine girders on 6-inch diameter iron columns. So it was pretty sturdily built. Say that again? They didn't know how to build them, and this was all virgin timber too, probably. This was not regrowth. So this was solid. The architect was J. Cleveland Cady, who a few years later designed the first Metropolitan Opera House, which wasn't too far away from here. So I have no idea if the sound of this was due to his beautiful architectural design. I do know that the Metropolitan Opera House burned down sometime later, and so the good Metropolitan Opera House was created after that. From 1897 to 1923, it was also occupied by the Armenian Evangelical Church. They moved what's pretty much around the corner to East 34th and 3rd Avenue in 1923 and are still there. Various reports that you see, including Wikipedia, say that the building was an abandoned Greek Orthodox church, but that's probably easier to say than Armenian Evangelicals. So I haven't been able to find anything about Greek Orthodox people being there. And it had been gone a long time by the time the studio came around, but I think the Presbyterians were still there. So this is a picture from the Evangelical Church's website and is also in their lobby. And this year they're celebrating their 120th year as a church. And they had as part of that, they had a sign up saying, come to our friendship hour. And I went to a service there in April and hung around and talked to them afterwards and told them about my project. And they thought it was pretty cool. The pastor is a jazz fan and looked up the thread right then while we were talking. And I said, geez, you know, if you have any pictures, send them to me. So before I get to that, we're going to look at this picture. And I zoomed in a little bit on this to show that, where's my thing here? This is the 3rd Avenue L, which got torn down in late 1950s. And here's the church part of it. This building here is still there, although this entrance is now down below here. There's no steps there anymore. And this building here is still there, although it's missing the fire escape here. But it's remarkably looks the same there now, except for this part. But you can see, I want to call your attention to some things about the building here. You see the front is flat over where my cursor is, but it bulges out right here. This is the main entrance, and there are a couple of other entrances here and over at the other end, but there's a fence going across between this bulge to block these other entrances, so you can tell those are not the main entrance. So the main entry was right in the middle there. Then up on the second floor, I want to call your attention to these taller windows here in the middle, these three, flanked by these slightly smaller windows, and then there's some other stuff up above and a nice rose window up at the top. So a couple days after I visited them, I got this from the secretary saying, this is our home before we moved. And I thought, God, this is really great. This is the first time I've seen any picture of the inside of this building from before the studio time. But then I started looking at it more closely and I thought, wait a minute, what are these columns doing in the middle of it? The studio space that you're going to see is a beautiful soaring space that's open everywhere, and there's no windows in the space. And then I kept looking at it closely more and thinking, wait a minute, these are two of the three windows on the second floor of that upper floor, and then this is one of the smaller windows on the eastern side of the building. I thought, well, of course, this is how they were able to occupy the same space for 30 years or whatever. They had their own space, and the Presbyterians had their own space big down below. So that made total sense, but it doesn't tell us anything about the studio. But this is the only picture of any kind of the second floor of the building that I've been able to find.
Dan?
Yes. Here, talk in the mic. Talk in the mic, Mike.
Oh, okay. Hold up here. Here you go, Mike.
Yeah, right next to you.
Looks like there are 46 stars. What year was that taken?
Would it be before 1923?
Yeah.
That's the best
certainly.
I can say.
No, New Mexico or Arizona.
That's exactly.
Okay.
That's a long time ago.
Yeah. Thank you. I hadn't noticed that. But do you know enough to know when a 46 star flag would be?
Well, yeah.
Before
1912? Before 12? I guess.
Wow. Yeah, it wasn't Arizona like 1912?
It was right around there. Yeah,
okay.
I'm sorry, I don't remember. For
okay,
sure.
Well, that's fine. Thank you. Okay, thank you. So now we're going to go, this is a 1940 picture, and this is a tax assessor's photo, and I know that because of the sign there, which is identifying the block, lot, and borough that this building, the pointer, is pointing to. And the assessor did that in 1940 for the last time, or approximately this time anyway. And you'll note that it is in disrepair. If you look up in the belfry here, you see that these slats, which are supposed to protect it from the weather, they're missing completely right there. So that means either they're not taking care of it, or it's abandoned, or they can't afford to fix it, or something. It still has the sign, Adams Church, right there. So whatever that means. But it doesn't look completely abandoned. So anyway. Now this again is that same picture that you saw earlier and shows how, in fact, they did just chop off the towers right there and fill them in with brick and fill in this gap between above this ornament and filled in with brick and just chopped off. I don't know what the roof looked like. I assume it had a little slope to it because they get a lot of snow there. This is travertine marble down here, and they filled in all of these windows here except for these doorways right there. This is the main personnel entry door, and I'll show you later why I know that. And this is where the gear came in and out, and we'll see that also. And that's the deal. I've got a series of these, and I don't know that we're going to have time at the end. We could. I mean, I guess we can do whatever we want here. I won't there in New York. But I've got a series of these where these guys are going down the block, and they were obviously taken at the same time with the same cars and stuff there. And to me, that's fascinating. This one here, one of them is from Ashley Kahn's really great book called Kinda Blue, which is also a wonderful reading about the making of that album. And there's some good pictures and stuff about how to do that, how to do a recording, and how that one came about. So another occupant of the building was WLIB Radio, and they were there from 44 to 52. And this was interesting to me. In October 44, the New York Post publisher bought WLIB for $250,000. That's right in the middle of the war. So they must have been doing pretty well by selling updates of the what was happening in battle. In November of that year, 44, the city license for the radio station was officially changed to New York, and the studios were soon moved to 207 East 30th, which is this building. So they were there. So in 47, the studio construction, the first sessions, and then another transformation in 49. So please, no pictures past this point here. And again, ask people who come in if they start taking pictures. I don't think we'll have a big rush, but just in case. Okay, in October of 47, Columbia Broadcasting System filed this next floor plan that you're going to see for the first floor of 207. And it's going to show what we know of the old control room with the old floor plan, with the old stuff there. So this is the drawing, and I can't read this for anything. This is totally useless. And unfortunately, Gary Louie couldn't be here tonight. But I gave him this, and he took it and photoshopped into this. And I think that we should give Gary some applause right now, because he's not going to get it. I mean, isn't that awesome? That is so clean. This is the studio back in this part here. And you remember on the floor, the building plan, it showed these cut-off corners here. And there they are right there. And this right here is the recording control room, the studio control room that overlooked the studio. Here's the entrances. And see, you can see there's a double entry here, because in cold weather, you don't want the air to just flow in. You want one door open and one door closed. So the security guard was over here, and you could go in, or you could go in and across, and you could go upstairs or downstairs. Over here is the equipment entrance, and there's just one set of doors, and there's double doors out here for sound isolation, I assume. There was a later control room that was down in here, along with a machine room, and there's also another studio that was over here somewhere that used to be the sacristy for the church. But there are no pictures whatsoever. There's lots of pictures of the control room over here, the new one, which you'll see later. There's sort of an angular view of the tape room, which you'll see later. I'll show you. But there's nothing whatsoever of any of the rest of this space. So this is all terra incognita over here. And there's one picture that I have of one of these stairways, and that's about the extent of what I know not there. Dan, now you notice, yes, Steve?
The picture you showed before the second floor would be above this.
I haven't showed a picture of the second. Oh, yes, you're right. It would be above This part right here.
Right.
Yes, so that's what you where mean. That other church was. But there's no indication, there's nothing for sure that it stayed that way after they were gone. What I've heard is that there were offices and stuff up there. But when you ask Frank what was up there, he said, I don't know, I never went up there. In 30 years, he never went up there.
And the back was so, open to 100 feet, right?
The back was open, and we'll get to that in a minute, yes.
So that would be, the front was actually segmented.
The front was actually segmented.
Floors.
Oh, yes, yes. This part here went up for 3 floors and maybe even 4. This part here was 1 floor on the main floor and then open to the height that it was entirely. Yeah, thanks for clarifying that. Now, here's the basement that Gary also cleaned up.
Dan?
Yes.
Can you go back one slide?
Yes.
Where's the old control room?
This is it right here.
Okay.
That right there. And I'm going to zoom in a little bit on these in a second here, because this is really the guts of what's going on. You'll notice there was no bathrooms in that drawing of the first floor. The only bathrooms in the place were in the basement and on the second and third floors. So this is a drawing that Gary cleaned up again of the basement. And you can see that this is the studio space. And this says unexcavated right there. And actually, I'm going to zoom in a little bit. I've got a better, slightly more zoomed in thing. Unexcavated. There were for sure, this is the furnace area in here and air conditioning. And there were ducts going underneath this unexcavated place because there were vents on this wall and on this wall, which I think we'll see in a minute here. But it's otherwise unexcavated. And this doesn't make any sense to me because in the old days, this would have been a coal furnace, and the coal delivery would have been the only place to deliver is from the street here. So they would have had to put it in here and then get it over there somehow. So I don't understand how that all worked. But anyway, here are some bathrooms here. There's a men's and women's there with 2 holes apiece, and then a one-holer, 2 one-holers over on this side. And I don't get why you would do that. And then some storage and dressing rooms and stuff down here. And I'm sorry this projector is flickering, but it seems to be. I only have one picture that I've found of a small part of the basement. And I have no idea what is in the rest of it. Actually, I take that back. There's a couple other pictures of something that I call the control man's lounge, which had to be down here somewhere. But I don't know which of these rooms there was. And Frank told us that there was a reverb chamber down here someplace. And my guess is that it would be over here somewhere, because that's the closest to the control room. So you had to wire back and forth. So I'm guessing it was here, but I don't know that for sure. Now here's another drawing that Gary did that shows dimensions. The overall building here is 98 something wide. The overall building is 100 feet deep. And we saw earlier that the roof was about 60 feet tall. So when Frank told us that the building was 100, the studio space was 100 by 100 by 100, he had to be technically wrong. It couldn't possibly, the studio space couldn't possibly have been that. And in fact, it was more like 83.4 by 57.8. And Gary wanted me to tell you that these are within about 6 inches because the plans are a little warped and this was the best he could come up with. So the reality was that the studio space was about those measurements by about 40 to some feet tall. In fact, the spirit of the space, Frank got exactly right. It was a great big space. It was really long, it was really wide, and it was really tall. And that, as the studios go, this is how it is. JJ, talk into the mic, please.
What was the shape of the ceiling?
Varied. You'll see that in a minute here. Looking in a little closer on it, these up here are closets of some sort to store stuff in. They don't go outside at all. There's no backyard or anything. So it's 99 floor long. There's 8 steps up to the control room from the studio floor to the old control room. This is about 12 feet deep by a little less than 20 feet long. The entry is down here, and there's an entry over there. There's a sign on this wall here that says maximum capacity is 350 people, which is an interesting thing, and we'll talk more about that in just a second here. Here's the bottom part. This is the sidewalk right here. The street is on the outside, further down. We know you can get up and down. Again, as I described, there's nothing to show you what's in between here. There was somebody who was there, maybe even a couple people, who swear that they walked in the door, took about 3 or 4 steps, and walked into the studio. And there's no possible way that that happened. This is about 30 feet or so there. And it's just another example of how 50 years, you know, things can change in your head compared to what they really were. But it was not very big. There's also some doors over here, and I have no idea what those are to. The tape room is over here, and there could be some entry to that, but it's not shown. I have one picture that looks roughly this way, and there's no door right there, so there's a lot of mystery. Yes, Steve?
On the staircase, it says up and down.
Yes.
Which is the first floor, which is the second floor?
The up is going to the second floor, the down is going to the first floor.
So you come in and you can go straight up?
You come in and you can walk up to the second floor, yes.
Thanks.
Sure. Okay, now we're going to talk about the original old, what I call the old control room. It was a freestanding structure on the west studio wall. And these next couple pictures are taken by Don Hunstein, and they're much later than 1948. But this structure didn't change too much during that time. But you can see what a beautiful soaring space it is. And JJ, you asked what the ceiling was like, and you can see that there's beautiful beams up there. Pardon me?
A lot of facets.
Vastness, yeah.
Facets.
Facets, yes, very much. Lots of slopes, lots of broken up stuff. And this is from 50-something, so it's later. So it didn't look like this at the beginning, I don't think. And
those,
it didn't look like that in between.
Probably the rope story, the comedian fly story, speaking as a former Presbyterian.
Okay. Where would the altar have been?
There's
straight ahead as you walked up?
Two
altars.
There's an altar and a lectern.
Altar, yeah.
The
lectern.
Altar is on that side, is where the ecclesiastical stuff happens. The lectern is where stuff like the announcements and stuff happen.
Yeah. And sermons.
The sermons go, well, it's complicated.
Okay. We won't get into it now. So do you think when you walked in that front door from the street, with the street going this way behind you, and you walk straight in, is the altar straight ahead of you, or is it to your left?
You'd be looking probably toward it.
From the street.
Usually, you would come for some reason.
Yeah.
The left side of the building, the general population would come in the back.
General population comes in the middle.
No, it comes in the middle into that center space, and then would come into the back of the sanctuary. The elders and the presbyters and all that would come in the other side.
This is the main entrance right here.
Right.
So you walk through this area,
and
you walk in here, or you walk in here?
Yeah.
And then this is the front?
That would be the front. That's the most likely.
Yeah, that's what I think, too.
That's the most likely.
Okay. Because usually you look down there, and you come in the back so you don't disrupt the service. You don't come in the middle if the altar is here. Yeah, okay, good. But I have no proof of that. So back to this one. This is the control room window that we can see in the distance here. And it's a little hard to tell, but it stops right here. The control room stops here. This is open space above it. It sticks towards us from the wall.
So that would be from the short axis of the rectangular room?
This is looking from the short axis from the far end.
It's the long axis.
This is the long axis.
Okay.
So this is north here. This is west, this is east. So that picture is taken from east looking west.
Long axis.
looking along the long way from the short angle, from the short wall. And then here's closer to it. This is also Glenn Gould. And you can see through the window up there. And this is a unique shaped window. I've never seen any place else that has this. So when you see this shaped studio window, you can be pretty guaranteed that this is 30th Street. You can see up in the reflection here that there's all of these lights hanging down, and that is fairly distinctive too, except that they had another studio called Liederkranz Hall that also had these lights in it, and you can see, and it also had arches in it, and you can see stuff that looks like 30th Street that because it's those lights, but it's not. It's Liederkranz.
That's all one solid pane of glass?
No, I believe this is three. You can see, and the next picture will show that too. This is looking kind of through the glass, and you can see this is a joint right here and another joint right there. So there's three big panes and maybe even four, I don't know. But that's one big pane of glass. Sorry? I'm not aware that this opens, no. I've never seen anything indicating that there's any sliding opening action. The door to it is behind this. This, I'm pretty sure, is a studio monitor. It's an RCA one, and there's another one on the other side that we have a lot of pictures of. The only entrance or exit door is behind this, further back. This area over here is the producer's section. This right here is the mixing console, and the mixer person is there. And then here are tape machines that were there after tape machines were happening. And again, this is a later picture than the first studio opening. There are no pictures that I found of that time.
Is that possibly 1955 when he did the Goldberg? I seem to recall a photo, maybe that photo, where it showed the four panels.
He was in there a lot.
Steinway was there bottom, yeah. Bottom in. He said, I kind of like this one now.
It could be. There's no way to date that I'm aware of. The pictures. So looking at the mixing console, this picture is an example of how I look at the pictures. I'm looking kind of behind all of these people who are in the way that the picture is actually about. And this is a mixing console back there. We'll look at that more in a minute here. I want to identify these people. On the left is David Oppenheim, who at this time I'm pretty sure was a Masterworks assistant producer or something. And he was also married to Judy Holliday, the actress, at this time, although that later disappeared. And he, after he left Columbia, he went to New York University, I think, or Pace University, one of those, and was a dean of something and was responsible for the art school and a huge building program that people are very proud of. And you can Google him, David Oppenheim, and see the amazing things that he did. This fellow in the middle here is Goddard Lieberson, who at this time was the head of Masterworks Classical, which is CBS's or Columbia's classical imprint. He later became the president of CBS, of Columbia Records, and he was also on the board of directors, I think at this time, of Columbia Records. So he was a big guy and a graduate of the University of Washington, amazingly enough. Yeah. And I'm convinced that he's the reason that all of the artistic and cultural amazing things that Columbia did are because of him. He was a very erudite and sophisticated person and married a wonderful woman, Vera Zarina, who was a dancer and an amazing person in her own right. This guy over here is Howard Scott, who was involved in the editing of tapes and stuff when the LP was first created, and was a producer of many, many, many classical and jazz and other really interesting albums and productions. And those two, I would really love to have a lot more information about them because they just seem like really fascinating people. And I'm going to pursue that at some point, I hope. So here's another shot looking behind Goddard at that mixer. And I'm pretty sure this is not a studio recording mixer. This is some kind of broadcast mixer, I'm pretty sure. And this may have been there from the radio days, I don't know. But this is about that vintage. And looking a little closer at it, just got 1 meter on it. There's 9 knobs across the face of it here. It looks like there's some lights that can be lit up when it's muted or not muted or soloed or something, and a bunch of knobs and dials and stuff up there. If you know what this is, I'd be happy to know what it is. Here's another shot of it, but also showing Fred Plaut in his younger days. And you can see here there's an awesome name tag on the side of this mixer, and if we could just get rid of the blur, we would know what that is. But we can't. I don't know who this fellow is, but there's several pictures of him. You can see the back of the mixer here, and these are Canon P3 connectors, and it sure looks like there's more than 6 or 8 of them there. I don't know what's going on, if they can switch between microphone connectors around the room and control what's listening to or anything. Remember that hinge mortise that I showed you behind Frank Lako? This picture here was what helped me figure out what this is, what it was. These are some studio monitors attached to above the window there. They're held in place by these hinges that let you change the angle down so that it's facing the guy. These must have sounded crappy because they didn't live there very long, and they were taken out and they just left the holes for the hinges. And I thought that was awesome. That made my day when I found that out. And you can see this isn't this RCA speaker in the corner here. It looks like a cabinet. And there are people who know what the name is, and I forget, frankly. So we're going to look at some of the stuff that's in the studio, the microphones. Here's Leonard Bernstein in the studio. I don't know what year this is, but these are all RCA 44, I think, microphones all over the place there. And here's what it looks like. This is a picture from Coutant.org. And it was interesting that Columbia was using microphones that had the RCA nameplate on them, because Columbia and RCA were not buddies specifically. So it had to pretty much cheese them off to use these RCA things. So they would get them and cover it with their name, which is pretty cool. And incidentally, this is Paul Robeson and Aaron Copeland in the studio. Here's another microphone that they used in those early days, the Western Electric 604AA, and that's Alfred Drake and Kiss Me Kate in 1949. That thing looks kind of like a pop bottle to me, but it's a microphone, and it apparently sounds really good. So the recording medium, when it first opened, there was nothing on site to record sound. They had leased equalized telephone lines that they sent to their main studio complex at 799 7th Avenue South, where it was recorded onto lacquer or wax discs of some sort. There's no on-site recording capability again. So in 48 October, there was a permit application as a place of assembly. And the space was going to be used to hold 350 people as a studio audience for radio and television studios and offices. And that was a mind blower, because this building was actually purchased not to be an audio recording studio. It was purchased to be a TV studio, because TV was happening at that time. They have this other studio complex called Liederkranz Hall that was all set up as a audio recording space and was all acoustically treated and everything, and they were going to keep that as their audio place and turn this into the TV studio. But somehow, between October and December, they decided, no, they're not going to do that. They're going to record audio in this space and turn the other thing, tear out all of the audio stuff from the other studio and turn it into TV studios. So the first recording that I've been able to find that was done in the studio is this one with Mozart, with Robert Casadesus on piano, with Charles Munk conducting the New York Philharmonic Orchestra. And it's important to know that there was a thing called the Petrillo recording ban, which was in effect in New York and maybe the whole country, that was prohibiting recording of instrumental music of any kind. You could record vocal trios or quartets or something, but you couldn't record any instrumental stuff because the union wasn't getting their fair share of the record royalties. And they banned it completely, and it went for almost a whole year. And finally, in 1948, in December, they lifted it, and they rushed back into the studio. And I cannot believe that this was the first thing, that getting this huge orchestra in there was the first thing. I would think they would rush in Frank Sinatra or whoever, but I haven't found any documentation of that. So, yes.
A couple of things about that. If you want to impress the New York crowd, it's Cassata Sud.
Okay.
Robert Cassata Sud.
I get it wrong every time I say it.
And then the other guy, instead of Munch, it's Munch. And what is so surprising...
No, it's Munch, I thought.
Well, what's so surprising is the who later was the conductor of the Boston Symphony, is recording the New York Phil there.
Right. He was with the New York Phil for about 3 or 4 months, and then Boston took him away.
Yeah.
And this was during the brief time that he was in New York. So I'm going to let you read this, and if I hit this arrow, it should play back. This is a section from that first one. Sorry, I faded it out. So I missed the first part, but it was very similar to what you heard.
Did you notice how all the attacks of the piano sounded a little bit, almost like they're doubled?
Yes.
That's because of the equalized line. If you look at the Greek delay of it.
Seriously.
If you look at the Greek
interesting
delay of the 8 kilohertz equalized line, the only way to describe it is.
No fooling. Okay. That's really interesting, and I'm going to wait until the end to say why it didn't occur to me that it would be that would be due to that.
Because it will go away when they get tape decks into this same room.
Okay.
Is there any chance you happen to have the names of some of the people who were playing on that session?
Maybe. One of the things that I got from Sony was the American Federation of Musicians recording logs, which they used to make sure that all of the musicians were paid. So on those ones that I have, which does not mean I have one for every session that there ever was, but on the ones that they have, they list every single musician on there. So possibly I can look at that at some later occasion.
Admittedly, it's very geeky, but there are some people who would be most interested in who some of those players were.
Great. I didn't use that one for my names thing. I used some later ones, but there's hundreds of people on those things. Okay, so we're going to go to the next stage in the studio's life. So sometime between January and April of 49, they added polycylindrical diffusers on the walls, and they put in some concave portable sound baffles. I've only seen them in pictures used twice, but because Plaut mostly did classical stuff, they wouldn't be using those for that, probably. I know for sure they were used on some Johnny Ray recordings, because I have a picture of him next to it. So we're going to see what those are. What are polycylindrical diffusers? Well, those are these half-round things that are mounted on the walls in almost every spot. There's the recording. There's the control room again. So they're all around there. I'm not sure what this thing is. I think that this is two baffles, that this is a shadow falling on, but I'm not certain of that. It looks like a giant baffle, but I'm not sure. These, you'll see that in a second here. And this is the 1951 original studio cast of Porgy and Bess with orchestra and Lehman Engel conducting. And here's the Leonard DePoor Choir. And I put this one in because maybe you can see that arch there is bricked in. There's all of this crosshatch of brick up there. So I'm guessing that was some kind of stained glass window that they filled in, maybe, behind the altar, which would make sense to me. Mike?
You mentioned Goddard
Gleibertson. Yeah, Mitch.
From
UW.
Washington,
yeah.
At the University of Washington, room 35 downstairs.
Right.
Below the sub. You know, Gary
right.
knows all about it.
Where the...
Or are you going there?
There's polycylindrical diffusion there. When were those put in, though?
They were, well, the building, the whole structure was roughly, what, 1949, 50?
Yeah. So that might have been a fad. And I don't want to talk any more about the UW building. I got a lot to race through here.
That may have been influenced by that.
It could be.
Because it's in the 1959 audio engineering, or what is it, the audio encyclopedia.
Great. Rick?
Harry Olson from UWA's RCA promoted polys in his book on studio acoustics.
Cool. I can tell you a lot more about a lot of stuff, but I don't have time. So I would love to talk a little more about that. I know some more about it, but I'm not going to tell you now. I will tell you a little more, though. This is the Leonard DePoor Choir, and I wanted to point out that you're seeing a lot of black people in the studio because CBS and Columbia were pretty colorblind at this time when there was a lot of non-colorblindness going on. And John Hammond was a champion for civil rights, and he was buddies with Goddard, and I have no doubt that they influenced each other. And there was a lot of merit-based promotions and work going on rather than that. Now, here's a close-up of those things, and you can see that they're plywood. They're bent plywood over some kind of frame, and there's furring strips or something underneath each side of there where they're attached. And then I guess the plywood is bent over it or something. And again, here's the control room up here. And here are here's those concave baffles that I was talking about. So they roll around, and this is the business side of it here, which is totally nuts to me because a concave is going to focus sound. And one of the complaints about the building when it first opened was that it was too amorphous sounding and they wanted more focus. So a guy named Bill Savory designed these and put them in. And there you go. This is also indicative of how quickly I was taking pictures. I didn't clean anything. I was racing through these 40,000 things because I had no idea how long it was going to take. Here's David Oppenheim and Bruno Walter and these other concave baffles behind there. And this is one of their in-studio monitors, basically an A7 with some extensions around the port. Yeah, Isaac.
Is that CBI?
CBS. CRI, Columbia Recording Incorporated. They went through several names, or Columbia Records, maybe, Incorporated. And CBS came after TV stuff, Columbia Broadcasting System. Although the plans for this in 48 that I showed you earlier said Columbia Broadcasting System on them. Okay, in 1949, in December, WLIB was sold. Remember, she bought it in 44 for $250,000, and in 49 had problems and unloaded it for $150,000. I have no idea if either of those included the building. I've not found anything talking about that. But it somehow CBS acquired it during this time, from 46 to 49. And so the LIB guys left and was sold in 49. They stayed there, though. In roughly 52, it might be 51, they got a new mixing console to replace that broadcast one. I think it had 8 inputs and maybe 3 outputs, and here would be a few pictures of what it looks like. There's 8 right in here. I'm assuming these are something else since there's some more up there. There's some masters or something underneath this armrest that has a glass window in it so you can see what's going on, but you don't have to look at it all the time. There's lots of patch panels on either side. These doors are open, showing the stuff behind it. Here's one with the doors closed down there. This is a power supply for it, and I'll show you a close-up in a minute here. Here's the producer's area over here.
That room can get very hot.
Yes, this would be very hot. There's pictures that I'm not going to show you of Fred and the tape guy Bob Waller and Howard Scott all up with their shirts off and sweating and mopping their brows, because this has had to be very hot sometimes. Here's another one looking at the side of it. There's the power supply. These are all fuses. They're screw-in fuses. Again, this was built by CBS and designed. Here's one with the top lifted up so you can see how neatly it was done and beautifully. These consoles that they built were dead quiet. You could have it wide open, I'm told, by someone who was there, and stick your head up next to the control room monitor and not hear anything. And then they start to play, and it's like, holy crap, this is really loud. And they were built like tanks, really, really well done. And here's a color shot of it, showing the wood and the super comfortable chair for the operator. Yeah. And you know this is new because Goddard is fooling around with this monstrous technological device. And these guys, I'm pretty sure, are going over the blueprints, coordinating, showing what happened. Okay, in 52, WLIB moved out. And they had moved their programming to emphasize the African-American audience and figured moving up to Harlem would be awesome, and they're still up there today, although they got bought by Emmis, and so they're somewhere. And I tried to go and see if they would have any history, and I got no phone calls. So as of 52, Columbia had the entire building. Yes?
Would the radio station have been upstairs then?
I was told that the radio station had its offices up on the third floor, but I've not seen anything proving that. But they had to be somewhere. They probably weren't on the second, and they weren't down in the basement, so they certainly weren't on the first floor, so that kind of narrows it down. So outside in 1954, this is a break from the pajama game recording session, I'm pretty sure. And the WLIB sign is still out there 2 years after they're gone. So Columbia didn't really care about that stuff, apparently. This is Goddard hanging out with everybody. And he was in the studio a lot. There's a ton of pictures of him there, and he was very hands-on producing. There's pictures of him coaching somebody from as far away as you are to your neighbor here. And the poor talent is in front of the microphone, and he's doing this. So he was really there a lot, and that's why I think he had a lot of say in what was happening and what got left alone and what didn't get left alone. So from 49 through 56, the microphones are somewhat similar, although they're going to change. I guess here they're changing. This is the Altec M11 on the left here and an RCA 77 on the right. This is another shot from the Porgy and Bess session, and that's what that Altec M11 looks like, although it looks to me skinnier in that other picture, but this is what these guys show.
And the diaphragm's on top?
This is the diaphragm up here, and apparently there's interchangeable diaphragms because this one has the M21 capsule, and apparently there were other ones, but these guys didn't have any. Yes, Rick?
I think mostly it was Omnis, and you could get a measurement capsule for it, which
okay.
was calibratable.
Huh.
And that was commonly known as the Coke bottle mic.
Right. Okay. And then you've all seen that one before, for sure.
Is that indeed a 77, not a D or a DX?
It just said 77. Well, there was about 50 77s in the Coutant thing, and I just said 77. This is a 77, so you got me. So here's Fred with another mic, the RCA KU2A, and this may have been an earlier mic too, but I never saw pictures of it in use earlier. This is called the Skunk because it's got this white stripe here, and this is the front and this is the back. So this, I believe, is a cardioid. Rick?
Wes Dooley is making
reissue of this?
Reissue.
Oh, cool.
Yes. Well, it's technically copy of the KU3. It was originally a soundstage mic, and
yes.
The white stripe is so that the operator of the boom could tell where the hell he's aiming.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah.
But it is a cardioid?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah,
okay, good.
One of their earliest versions.
Cool. I saw some ads for this while I was looking around for it for like $8,000. So you could buy that. And that might have been a couple of years ago.
Buy the AEA one.
And here's another shot of an M11 with Benny Goodman and some sidemen. And now we've got the Neumann U47, which I think is the first Neumann that was in use at this studio. Was it the first Neumann at all?
Not sure.
Yeah.
Not sure.
Here's what it looks like.
I mean, there were mics before that.
Yeah.
But the 47, I think, was the first to come across the pond.
Okay. It was certainly the first one here.
So Neumann and Telefunken's the same thing?
Apparently.
Yeah.
That's what it says.
Neumann made them for Telefunken.
Okay.
And also during those years, the M49 came out, and Frank said this was his favorite mic, and we see tons of those in pictures with him. Okay, tape machines. The first ones were mono, full track, Ampex 300. This is Rudolph, and correct my pronunciation, for Kuzny.
Yeah, that's right.
Okay, awesome.
With a cigar, we can, not just cigarettes.
Yeah, yeah. It's amazing how many people were smoking in the studio everywhere.
Tape heads.
Yeah. And this is the original console in front here. This is the other side of it, and it looks like there's a P3 connector too, and was that a talkback mic or something?
Well, that's probably coincidental. He's reading the paper in front of that. I mean, he's a fine pianist, but I didn't know he was...
People were eating and drinking and doing all kinds of things on the console. Here's a shot of Rudolph Serkin. Also with that Ampex full track mono, and I've got to think he's thinking, so this is the future here, huh? Here's another shot that we owe to this guy falling asleep that Fred thought it was awesome to take a picture of. This is an Ampex 350 two-track recorder in a portable case, and the question was, why is it in a portable case? Were they moving it around from studio to studio? And nobody knows.
Maybe they did remotes with it.
Yeah. They could have.
Yeah.
How many people did it take to carry it?
Good. But it had handles.
Yeah, what do you need?
I've seen an MR-70 in a portable case.
Yeah.
I wouldn't call it, but that's only portable if you have a forklift.
So for this era, I chose from the pajama game Hernando's Hideaway by Carol Haney.
A place where no one knows your face. A glass of wine, a fast embrace. It's called Hernando's Highway. Mole.
Isn't that great? I remember hearing that a lot when I was a kid.
It's great room in the
recording.
Yeah. Yeah, I tried to pick some that showed the room. And it's hard to know what was the room and what was the reverb chamber down below. You know, and then these were taken over to 799 7th Avenue to be mixed and processed, and they had a stairway that was their reverb chamber, and so it's hard to know what was going on. But you're right, it did sound good. I'm glad. I thank you for saying that. Okay, this is the leave it as it is era. When you look at pictures here, you'll see that's pretty much true, but only for this 6 years. And Frank talked about Mitch saying it, but like I said, I think when Goddard became president in 56, he had the power to say, you guys, this is what we need, and he was there all the time. So I think he got what he wanted. So in March of 56, there's this My Fair Lady recording session. The polycylindrical stuff is gone, replaced by temporary patches where they were attached to the walls. And you can see that during this session, there was renovation underway. And we're looking here at Robert Coote, Julie Andrews, and Rex Harrison. And you can see all of that stuff all over the place there. And this is a better version of it. And Rex, behind Rex Harrison there, you can see this wall that's got a lot of patches. This is some studs or something. And this is a wire that's going through back there. They haven't covered it over yet. And here are a lot of stripes of patching stuff where those furring strips were. And
it's like they're building a new control room in there.
They're adding on to the walls there and creating something solid where apparently there was not something solid. Or there was the polycylindrical diffusers were creating a barrier that was no longer there, I think. This is a Glenn Gould picture that's actually a month earlier that, taken by Gordon Parks for Life magazine. And any pictures that you look at from the, during this time period, you're going to see patches and crap on the walls there. The concave baffles disappeared about this time, and this stayed as was until they went to the new control room. Here you can see the patches and stuff up there. I put this picture in. This is from 1957 West Side Story, in part to show that, but also to show what a gigantic space this was. Here's a full orchestra starting over here, going way around and coming back to here. There's a chorus behind these flat baffles there. There's plenty of room for this guy to stretch out on this end of the studio. It's a nice big space.
And again, this is along the long way.
Looking the long way, east to west, looking towards the control room on the west wall. This is from Gypsy in 1959. Here's Goddard Lieberson, Fred Plaut, some dancers. This might be Peter Gennaro, I'm not sure. This is interesting, in standing in these baffles, this is Tio Macero, who was a producer of note of Miles Davis and a ton of other things, who really created Miles Davis's work in later years by recording lengthy sessions and then editing them into product that had no relationship to what was actually done in the studio. Bitches Brew, particularly for that. And there's a great book by a guy named Victor Sforinich called Bitches Brew that is really fun to read about how that session came about, but that's a diversion. Standing next to him here, this is Buddy Graham. And Tio was not a big guy, and Buddy was definitely smaller. And when Buddy came to CBS in 51, he looked like he was about 13 years old. And he won about 6 Grammys or more during his career there and did amazing work. And this is, to me, just another example of how CBS was merit-based rather than you had to be Hollywood good-looking to be part of it. Buddy's an interesting character, too. Here's in 58, looking up at the patches up above, Miles Davis session with Gil Evans there. Brad was the first one who told me about Gil Evans and how cool he was. This was this Porgy and Bess that Frank recorded at that time. In 57, 3-track tape machines came in. This is Eileen Farrell with some Ampex 300-3 recorders that we think have 350 electronics. And you can see in the back is that storage room in the control room with the door open. In microphones, there's not a lot of different changes. They don't go through them and discard them all. They use them over time as people are still using 1940s microphones. The only new one that I could find was the U67, and here it is with Miles Davis in the studio. Around 61, a lot of outboard gear appeared in the old control room. Here's Fred Plaut in the foreground with Tio Macero behind him and the 3-track over there. And here's a bunch of, are those equalizers or something? I count 8 of them there.
Those are Pultex?
Yeah. Awesome. Yeah. So there's 8 of them there, which is worth about 50 or 100,000 bucks today or something. A lot.
A few cars.
This is a couple of years later in March of 62, Julie Andrews and Carol Burnett TV special at Carnegie Hall. That could have been recorded there and they lip-synced. I'm not quite sure. They just rehearsed here or something. And you can see the door to the storage room is gone because the stuff is going all the way to the wall and there's no place to open it. And they're down to 5 of these Pultex here, and I'm not sure what happened there. That's Jim Fogelsong, the producer, who did a lot of really amazing stuff and who died a couple of years ago. And Garth Brooks wrote a really nice tribute to him. So this is three per, I couldn't come up with one song to sum up this period, so here's 3.
I left my heart.
So that was Tony Bennett, of course, the Brubeck Quartet, and Miles Davis. at that time. And I think there's really a lot to be said about the type of music that was recorded there being the perfect music for the space that was perfect for the kind of music. But we're not going to be able to get into that today. But that's been a fascinating thing for me here. So from 62 to 71, there was a new control room and a mixer. Sometime between April 1st and May 27th. And it was set in the south wall of the studio. And that's on ground level almost there. And there's an entry there. There's some short baffles here and a studio monitor here. What was that? Who are those people? This is Goddard Lieberson, as you say, Richard Burton, and Elizabeth Taylor. And I'm pretty sure this is right after they came back from Cleopatra, where there was the huge scandal of their deal. And that was the other amazing thing about 30th Street, is that people who were in the news were there all the time, and photographers and movie crews were coming in all the time to take pictures of these famous people. And that's another reason it was a fascinating space.
Yeah, is that control room glass the same location of the older control room glass?
No, that was on the west side, and that is still there. They didn't tear it out and move it over here. They left that and moved into this space. So it was like 8 years later or something before they finally tore down that structure. But they definitely moved during that time period that I mentioned, from one place doing recordings to this place doing recordings. This is the south side facing 30th Street. Yes, the road is parallel to that window, 38 feet away. Okay. Here's a color picture from Steve Epstein showing that there were some monitors above the window. And there's a door. This is how they got in and out. They must have got tired of those 8 steps going up and down to the other room and put this one down. This is 1 or 2 steps up. And you can see they stored their cables and junk over there. And usually the mic stands were stored over on the north wall, but that's it. This is one of Frank having a sandwich at the control room, at the control console. And I want to show this because it's showing the rack behind your patch panel back here, some kind of outboard thing that comes and goes. This is a door to the outside, and this is where the tape room was, tape machine room. You can almost see a tape machine there, and it continued on over behind this wall. And there are no pictures really showing what's going on in that room, so that's still a mystery. Regarding the console, it was another CBS design and built 20 input unit. And this is an example of it. This is not in 30th Street, but it's the best shot of the console that I have. And you can see these double rows of pods were set that way so that there would be the minimum spacing between it. They could kind of overlap it and fit more of these things in a narrower space. And there's 20 vertical columns here, which is usually indicative of inputs. And then the control room or the producer area is over on the other side of this, and I actually don't know what all of this stuff is. This, I'm guessing, is a power amp for monitors or something. And here is definitely in 30th Street with Thelonious Monk walking in front of the 3 speakers on the wall. And people have asked, why are there 3 speakers? And I don't know the answer to that, except they were recording 3 tracks, so maybe they were able to monitor each one. Rick?
In the time, you had one monitor per track.
Per track, yeah.
And after 4 track, it became obvious that it was impractical to continue that.
Right.
And so a separate mixer was created to create the monitor mix. That went into 2 speakers.
Right. And it's important to point out that what they were listening to here was not the final mix that the record happened. The control guys, recording engineers, were simply laying the tracks down on the tape, and then it went somewhere else and got mixed for release.
Is there any significance of the difference of the grill cloths?
Yes.
job.
Thank you.
I have no idea. Okay, this is a screen cap from the 1970 movie Company, which you can watch on the internet or buy for $100. I bought it back when it wasn't $100, and it's pretty awesome watch, and we could watch that sometime if we needed a movie subject. D.A. Pennebaker came in to record this entire thing, and it went the entire recording session, and it went from like 9 in the morning until 4 in the morning, and it was dramatic, and it's really a cool movie, and Fred was the engineer for most of it. You can look through into the tape machine room here. You see the guy is standing in the window. That poster on the wall is Bruno Walter, and I'm pretty sure that's a picture that Fred took, because I have that picture in his...
Who's the other guy?
The other guy is Thomas Z. Shepard, who was a producer. And at this point, he looks like he's a teenager, but he had been a producer for about 10 years already there. And the movie is really great. I'm going to show you an excerpt of it here in a second. And it's going to be now. There's Fred. Now we're walking into the studio from the equipment door. That's a Stephen Sondheim work, and he's in it a lot, and it's amazing to see them working together. I'm going to skip that picture there. Go to tape machines. This is Bob Waller, and I asked some experts to comment about tape machines. Rick was one of them, but first, this is Luke Pacholsky. He says, all of the transports in the photo appear to be Ampex 350, 351 transports. I think the transport for both was the same. For the four-track behind Bob Waller, the tape operator, the transport is again of the 351 variety, while the electronics above appear to be 351, except for the third one from the top, which appears to be a 350. Note the rounded meter window on the 350 compared to the square meter window below. See, that's what we're looking for. All of those machines must have been custom, as I don't think Ampex offered the 350, 351 as a half-inch version. My guess is that they were cobbled together by Columbia technicians, unless there are controls not seen. It doesn't look like the four-track had cell sync controls for overdubbing. I say doesn't look like because the controls I've seen of Columbia's custom 8-track machines, probably not used at 30th Street, don't appear to have cell sync controls, but I would presume they would have had cell sync ability for overdubbing. Okay? And here's another one that was probably not at 30th Street. And Rick said that these are Scully 284 tracks, and there's a Langevin power supply and Macintosh amp at the bottom of the tall rack there.
HP oscillator on top.
HP oscillator. Okay, cool. Thank you. Thank you. So 8-track came in about 1968. This is Ted Brosnan, who did a bunch of really great recordings for Columbia. Luke said the 8-track machine behind him has either AG300 or 350 electronics, which might be the same anyway. I can't see the transport. If stock, it would be the AG300. If a custom Columbia machine, it could be anything. Rick said, the machine we can only see the transport is likely a 350 or 351. The 8-track might be an Ampex AG300. The blurry machine in the far background looks like a 4-track using 354 electronics. See, that's interesting to tape people. I don't get it at all. Yes. The 8-track came in somewhere around 68 as a thing. Whether when it came to Columbia, I don't know.
Yeah, Ampex pretty much stopped the 350s pretty quickly, and they were 300s, and then they went to the 350s. I've got a 4-track AG350. I'm
awesome.
Going there right now. But
awesome.
It looks just like that.
Cool.
The 350s had a much more stable transport than the original 300s. They had to lift them to
cool.
Things in, but
cool.
A little flimsy, but the 350s were quite workhorse.
Would you mind staying a little afterward and I can take notes on that? I would love to get that. Thank you. Like I say, that just doesn't stick in my head. I'm sorry. I'm not a tape guy. So, okay, now to the last era of the studio, from roughly 71 to May 29th, 1981. Sometime in the very early 70s, a CBS-designed and built linear fader console was installed there. The control room was remodeled, probably the studio too. Fred retired in 1972, so his photos are limited or non-existent, and I have a couple after that time, but most of these are from someplace else. So looking in the control room, this is from 1973, a little night music recording session. From left is Glynis Johns, Judy Kahan, Hermina Gingold, Stephen Sondheim, and Goddard Lieberson, who actually left CBS for some period and then came back around this time to be its president again for a while. Notice how you can just barely see on the left side the outlines of some knobs and stuff. This next picture here has that part of the thing. Are these graphics down here? It looks like there's different slider positions there. Maybe 10 band or something?
They're all in the same position, though.
Down to here, these are different. Those three are the same, but these are different. That's what makes me think they're movable.
Big knobs.
Nobody recognizes. Yeah, there's big knobs. Yeah, Rick?
Standard.
Move the mic over towards you there. The standard. This is a
graphic. The standard graphic equalizer in that era was the Langevin or Altec unit. They were 7-band.
Oh.
And 10-band kind of came, gee, I don't know. I think it was after we figured out how to do it with op amps.
Okay. I totally can't tell how many. It could be a couple small ones or a couple wide ones. I mean, that looks like a small one, and that looks like a wide one. So I don't know. Anyway, this is Steve Epstein right here, who is doing Broadway shows now and is busier than he's ever been, he says. I showed him these pictures, and he said, what's that shirt? I never wore a shirt like that. And then he looked closer at it, and he said, oh, yeah, this guy has one similar. I think he bought me this when we were out shopping, and I wore it to make him feel good about it. But it was really great. He was totally unaware that anybody had taken his picture back then. This is the Tokyo String Quartet with him. Now, here are some other pictures of the room that look quite a bit different. That picture with Hermina Gingold in that last one, the rack was behind the console. Now it's over here. And I'm pretty sure that this is 30th Street because of the relation of the door here to the control room, to the tape room area. I don't know.
The desk still has the rotaries.
Yeah, the desk still has...
The desk still has the rotary... Up there?
Yep.
Yes, yeah. Yes. But this is different down here. This was all maybe graphics down there on the other one, but now it's over there, so go figure. But yes, the console is still the rotor. Oh, no. You're right. This might still be the rotary fader. Well, interesting. Okay. No, I don't think it is, because look at this next one here. This is the slider console over here, and this is something else over here. I don't know what all of this stuff is.
That might be the monitor mixing.
Yeah.
Could be. Could very well be.
The racks have changed again, so there's
no, this is the same racks here, I think. as this last picture. These two are the same time. But this is definitely 30th Street out there. I can tell that much. So I know that this was at some point. I'm guessing these are the speakers. These are the monitor soffit there. I don't know that, but I'm guessing it must be. This is purportedly also 30th Street, but I don't think it is, because you can see tapes machines back through there, and you couldn't do that in 30th Street. This is Stan Tonkel, as much as we see of him there, and he was an engineer, a really nice guy, apparently, there. In the studio itself, there's now brown and other drapes, and they're clean looking, and it's more designed rather than engineer designed, it seems like. This is in July 28, 1978. This is a Roscoe Mitchell session for the song The Maze. And there's an unbelievable amount of percussion there. I count at least four drummers, drum kits there.
Legitimate drummers.
Legitimate drummers, yes. And a bunch of vibes and glockenspiels and stuff and other percussion of various kinds. And Roscoe was a horn player. So him plus 30 percussion guys. And I looked and looked, and I found this for $50 or $100 or something, but I could not find it anywhere reasonable cost. And I only found The Maze in one place, so apparently it didn't catch on. But it's a great picture. This is where the old control room used to be. And these are all dimmers to control the lights. And anyway, it's beautiful. Tape recorders. In 1971, there was 16-track with CellSync. And I went through the studio appointment books to get this information. They were booking the tape machines and outboard gear like they were booking the people, because it was needed to be in different places at different times. Okay, this is a picture of Don Meehan, who is an editor and performer. Rick says that this looks like an Ampex 300 with a AG440 electronics, but the odd part is the tape looks like 1-inch, but there are 16 electronics. I can't think of a reason to have a machine like this. Perhaps it was convertible between 1-inch and 2-inch tape. The standard was 8 tracks on 1-inch tape, 16 tracks on 2-inch tape. 2-inch 24-track came later. And the machine next to it looks like the same transport and 8 channels. The absence of other visible controls makes me think it is reproduce only. The machine on the right corner looks like a 300 or 350, 351 2-track. Next to it is anyone's guess, the one under the coat, I guess. Any thoughts?
When Ampex came out with the AG300, one of their goals was to make easily swappable heads.
Aha.
So you could change them out.
Aha.
You could use 1-track or mono for big. I mean, they didn't sell a lot of them. It was a nice idea, but it didn't catch on.
Okay.
All the mechanics are still there, so people who knew could easily swap out the heads.
Awesome.
I don't know, maybe Rick, you know when Fostex and Tascam overseas were experimenting with like the 16 1-inch when that started. But Ampex did have the goal to swap out heads.
I think the first Tascam half-inch 8-track, that happened when I was in the Air Force, so that's like 1970.
Okay.
And that's when they had the Model 10 console.
Okay.
That thing.
Yeah, because I just remember the 80s where it was 1-inch 16-track and it was all awful.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you. In 73, they sometimes call out Dolby or no Dolby, so that was an option. 74, they call out 24-track. They call out no Dolby, but they don't call out Dolby, so that must have been the standard was Dolby. Sometimes they had two 16 tracks that I heard were linked together to get 32 or some other combination. 75, they said sometimes that it was 30 IPS, 30 inches per second. 76, sometimes they called out an MCI recorder. These have all been Ampex so far that we've seen.
MCI cloned the Ampex machines.
Okay.
And did their own transports, but they started out by cloning the Ampex the audio electronics.
Okay.
And they sold it for less.
Well, there you go. In November of 79, they started seeing PCM 1600s, which were the analog to digital converters, correct?
Yes.
And two U-matics, which was the tape machine.
That's the ones that recorded with the video.
Video, yeah, that's what the U-matics were, I guess. Video, are those cassettes?
Yeah.
Some kind of cassette?
Yeah, I think those were video cassette machines.
Yeah, okay.
Three-quarter inch.
Okay. In 1980, you would see DBX noise reduction called for, as opposed to Dolby. And on three outside sessions, I saw that they had 3M digital recorders, but not seemingly any on any of their internal stuff. Then in 81, Mitsubishi and then the PCM and U-matic combination was common in studios, and sometimes JVC digital recorders were called for, and I never saw any model numbers or pictures of anything of those, so I don't know what those were. Were those 48 track? The Mitsubishi?
Don't
know. Okay. Microphones. Pretty much the only thing that was different was small diaphragm microphones. All of those other ones that we saw were large diaphragm. And Steve Epstein talked about how they wanted to use small diaphragm microphones, but CBS wouldn't let them. And finally, they got to use them. And I think there's a lot of fads in that world of what people want and don't want. So in January of 81, the New York Times ran an article announcing that CBS was trying to sell the 30th Street Studio. One of the engineers, Ray Moore, who was also a multi-Grammy winner, and I think he was head of either the AES or NARA sections in New York, ran a campaign to try to save the studio, buy it, and keep it going. The chairman of the board of CBS was a real estate guy, Lawrence Tisch, and the fad at the time was small studios that were real dead with low ceilings and low control room ceilings, and this was not that, and they figured they could make some money and save money on the studio space. And so in May 29th of 81, Glenn Gould did the last session in 30th Street. And interestingly to me, that week was completely unremarkable in its activity in the studio. The use just stopped. It went on normally.
Is that the second Goldberg?
This is the second Goldberg. This is the one that he recorded, the last one before he died. So he did the last session in the studio, and it was the last session before he died 6 months later or something like that. And this is a video that you can watch on YouTube that's of the complete session with him. And I don't know that that was recorded the last date. I can't figure that it was, but here it is anyway. It's clearly in 30th Street. It's clearly the Goldberg recording. And this is how it starts off, and let's see.
Put it all over again. So okay. Here we are, 25, 6, whatever it is, years later. We're going to try.
There was a microphone. Where did I get this audio? Yeah, I'll talk about that in a minute. That was not as visually compelling as I hoped for. One of the reasons given for selling the place was that the neighbors complained about the late night sessions and the noise. And I thought it was fascinating that the last week plus the studio was open, James Blood Ulmer was scheduled for these hours every night, from till 1:30 in the morning or later. And here are excerpts of the first three songs from the resulting album. So I got to figure that whoever did the scheduling for that gave a big finger to the neighbors the last week there. Yeah. However, on the other hand, for the last 2 weeks almost that the studio was open, the Juilliard Quartet, which is a wonderful string quartet produced by Steve Epstein's, were there for, this totals up to 62 hours. So he really had the honor of being the most the present, and it's in the last days of its career there. So this next three are said to be the last series of pictures of the studio taken by Don Hunstein. Here we are looking again at that far east end towards the west end, past the old control room, past the two pianos, and there's a great video, an interesting video. There's a morning show on CBS called Sunrise or something like that, and Charles Osgood, who used to be the anchor, is retired, and there was a segment showing him in his home in France with one of the pianos that he bought from the 30th Street studio and plays all the time. He's a really good pianist, and he still has that. So in this next picture, we step just a little bit to the left, and we're looking straight across the studio, past this rug. And now we go to the other end and look back and see the same chords on the floor. And that was it. So May 29th was the last session. On June 9th, there was a deed filed showing the sale by CBS to a person who I think is the head of the same family that owns it today. And you don't know who that is. It's just a person. It's not anybody you'd recognize. In June of 83, the application for demolition and removal was approved, and demolition was completed shortly after that. I've not found any pictures of anything like that. This is what it looks like more or less today. Big apartment condo building. Same address, though, 207. So that would be the end of the presentation, but Bob and I did this presentation for Frank's honorary membership that I thought turned out really great, and I wanted to play it again, and I'm going to play it in New York for people to see and hear. So here it is.
I left my
That's Colette, Frank's wife.
You can get anything you want at Alice's restaurant. Walk right in, it's around the back, just a half a mile from the railroad track. You can get anything you want at Alice's restaurant.
Then. Thank you. Yeah. Time. Yes.
Dan, is that video available someplace?
No. No, I don't know what to do with it because I got no rights to it. And I don't want to lose my YouTube standing. Yeah. Isaac?
How many years of your life does this constitute?
9 at this point.
Dan, is that? Saw.
Yes.
Is that that same thing where you're having very great difficulty with the codec, and we worked on that thing in the studio?
This is the same, except I re-edited the chorus line part and the Toots Thielman, Bill Evans part. When I made that, I didn't know Final Cut Pro video editing like I do now. I didn't know it at all, and I used Keynote for that, and the timing was a bitch. And every time I changed anything in the sequence, it threw off everything after it. And it took me about 40 hours or more to put that together, and I could never get the chorus line part to do the flip correctly, and Mike took it and redid it. But now I know Final Cut, and so I fixed it. And the Bill Evans part, I had a picture of Jim Hall with him and not Toots Thielman's. So I found a picture of each of them at the same time and put that in. So that's different, but the rest of it's the same.
Yeah, it looked very similar.
Yeah. JJ asked earlier where the sound came from for all of those things, and I don't have a record collection that encompasses all of that, so I used YouTube and got, there's a service that they recommend called the MP3 or something, which can capture either the video and audio or just an MP3 of whatever YouTube video you want.
The reason I asked is because the one thing...
Whoa.
Oh,
Chin fell asleep. No, I think that was me, I thought, but it was that one. Okay, good. Thank you.
The thing I was listening to was not coded. It was not that. It sounded like there's a whole bunch of wow on the one recording.
Oh, interesting. I was extremely worried about using YouTube audio for that. It the converter thing did it at 192 sampling bit rate. It was bit rate.
Yeah,
192.
Interesting. That wasn't the problem. There was a little bit of flutter. There was a lot of wow.
Yeah.
It sounded like some clipping, and that's not. You can't even do that in digital domain.
Awesome. Okay.
That came from
somewhere else. Well, that's good to hear, because I was extremely worried how that would go over with audio people. So that's something I would like to hear about.
Dan, what was the program you used to download? Because I recently, coincidentally, had to do that with somebody.
The YouTube stuff?
To download something from YouTube. Which
yeah, it's called THEMP3, I think.
I tried half a dozen of them.
Yeah, there were some other ones that seemed like they were robbing me or something, or doing something terrible. But this one seemed okay, and it let you trim the beginning and end too, so you didn't have to do the whole thing. But then it stopped working for me.
Dan, is the sound for that just the Glenn Gould recording there?
Say that again.
Is the sound for that video that
this last one?
Well, the one that JJ was saying had the wow and the flutter. Was it just Glenn Gould?
Was that the in studio?
Yeah.
That was a movie. Yeah. Don't know the answer to that.
I have that recording.
That was that video was less compelling than I thought it was going to be. Do you think that's worth including in the thing, the Glenn Gould video?
If you want a CD copy.
Yeah, the reason that I used it though was because of the video. I had some audio earlier in the in the names thing that had the Glenn Gould second half, second last performance in it. Let me think about that. I'm a little dazed right now, but yeah, let me think about
very,
that.
Very, very well done.
Anyhow,
oh, thank you.
If you're interested in another record, I thought overall I would include that.
Okay.
It was the last thing done there. The way they shot that and so forth.
So the video you thought was okay?
Yeah.
Okay.
Thank you. The only thing about it.
Yes.
Maybe we could find it. I may even have that if you want to.
Well, Greg just said he has it.
Yeah,
do you think you have the video?
Yeah, they made a remaster that has the remaster, the old one.
Yeah, there's no reason, there's no correlation, so I could put anything there.
Yeah, so let me know, Dan.
Okay, yes. The answer is yes. Anything else? This is 2 hours, you guys. This is more than 2 hours. And, yes.
I thought it was just amazing and really inspiring. Thank you so much. Yeah.
Well, thanks.
I wonder, are you going to, where you might take this, are you going to do a book?
I'm taking it to New York.
After that?
Somebody talked to me about doing a book, and my feeling about a book is that I have too much stuff that I don't want to contain in a book. But in thinking about it, a book would be a leader for looking into other stuff. To me, it's a really fascinating story, the whole thing. And if other people feel the same way, then they could get into some kind of look. I would love to show everything that I've got to anybody who wants to see it. Whenever they want to. I've got to figure out how to afford to do that.
You can do a subscription website.
Yes. And the database would be what would be served up. And I would be happy, if you know about that, I would be happy to talk to you about it. Greg?
In terms of your research, do you feel like there's a lot more that you're still uncovering, or do you feel like you kind of reached a point where your research has hit a point?
What's fascinating to me is that I think there is still a ton more to be found. I find stuff all the time. I've been working on this since the names thing I worked on from July until the beginning of September, and I've been working on this since the beginning of September, and in trying to nail down stuff like what songs were recorded there. In the walk-in thing, there was Johnny Ray Cry was playing at one point, and I wasn't sure that that was actually recorded in 30th Street, so I spent an afternoon looking into that, and I found a website by somebody interested in country music, who that is a country song, Cry, that other people have done, and he had all of these histories and discographies of all of these different ones, and it was in fact recorded in 30th Street on whatever date it was, and here are the people that were in it, and Buddy Weed was on piano, and there's a ton more to find, I think. And because I've been able to do this and find out these people, I went to Don Hunstein's memorial last Friday in New York at the Cotton Club. His wife invited me, and she had a picture presentation that Sony had prepared for her of Don's work, and she was showing these pictures, and she knew a couple of the people in it, but nobody in the room knew anybody else, and I was shouting out the IDs for 95% of the people in the pictures, and people were looking at me like, who the hell is that? And that was pretty neat. And then I got up and told them about the 30th Street thing, and a guy introduced himself to me as being Don's printer and wants to talk to me, and Don's assistant also wants to talk to me about some stuff. So
it's reminiscent of the Recording the Beatles.
Yeah. If you guys came to the Recording the Beatles meeting, there are these two guys from England that spent 15 or 13 years.
That's right.
They're domestic, but they went to England and they researched the gear that the Beatles used to record their stuff, which was all custom built by EMI. For Abbey Road Studios and their other studios too, and the documentation and knowledge of how to use that stuff was lost, so they basically wrote equipment manuals for all of the gear that was used there, and then they made this giant book with that stuff in it and pictures of the gear and two-inch tape box size. It was in that kind of thing, and that was amazing, and I couldn't imagine devoting 13 years to something, but I've already devoted 9 to this. So.
9 years.
9, yeah.
So is there any, the people that live in that apartment where the recording studio was, do they know what was there? Is there a plaque or anything?
There's nothing there, and I, the first year that I did the Friends of 30th Street, I went to that block and got addresses of all of the houses that were likely there then, and sent a mailing out with a few pictures on it. And I'm doing this research project. I'm going to have this meeting. If you want to come and see pictures of what was here on your block, please do. And I got two people called and said they were interested, and they watched it on, I was doing go to meeting then, and they watched it on that, and this one guy across the street called and talked to me, and I put my phone number in it too, and sent me that King's Handbook picture and told me about the people who were there before him who were there during the time. And the son of those people was accused, he's a doctor at UCLA or someplace, a professor, and he was accused by some guy as being the Zodiac Killer. Yeah. And the guy chased him for years and would accuse him in every forum and write stuff and long articles about how this guy had to be the Zodiac Killer and how he was here at this time. And it was like, holy shit, I'm in this rabbit hole. And this whole project has been kind of like that. It's just been fascinating learning about the theatrical people, and I didn't know anything about Stephen Sondheim or Hermina Gingold or whoever, and it's been really cool that way. So yes, I've tried for people on the whole block. There seems to be nobody there. There seems to be nothing in the building that is interesting. I've tried to give a presentation there because I love showing this, if you can't tell, and nothing happened so far.
One thing you did in this, you showed the back of a record cover, and the record cover said EMI at Abbey Road Studios 1975.
Okay.
Well, if you say EMI now, a few people will know what you're referring to. You said EMI made the equipment, you know.
Well, that was an album. I showed that because Frank's credit was there.
Yeah. And we recorded at EMI Studios.
Cool.
Abbey Road Studios, but EMI Studios, 1964.
Uh-huh.
There happened to be a street out there, yeah. But nobody called it Abbey Road. Everybody called it EMI Studios.
Huh.
That was it.
Okay.
So I just thought that was kind of interesting to see that little note.
Yeah, yeah, totally.
Just an observation, Dan.
Yeah.
It's not just, you know, a tribute to Frank Lyko or a memo of the 33 studio, but I think this is a vignette of what we consider the golden age of American recording.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this is really a shot into how it was done for this 30-year period.
Can you guys hear that, what he's saying there?
Okay. Yes.
Thank you. Yeah, you're right.
It's changed since then, but this was it, because I know I was, you know, part of the professional
right.
audio business, building equipment for this thing, but I mean, it was happening. This was where it happened. There was so much enthusiasm and money and everything. You know, we all went to the shows. We talked to all these people, the engineers, the musicians, everybody. I mean, it was like everything. It's this huge thing of building this whole empire of making better and better recordings.
And another aspect of that was that New York at post-war was the city of the world, because all the cities of Europe were pretty wiped out from the war. And a lot of the intelligentsia and artistic people had fled Europe to America, and many of them went through there. And Goddard and his people were totally tuned in. Fred was buddies with Igor Stravinsky. There's pictures of Igor at Fred and Rose's, his wife's house. Francis Poulenc, who was a composer. Rose was his favorite singer of Poulenc's work, and he would come and play piano. There's pictures of her singing while Poulenc is playing the spinet in their apartment. And it's just amazing how many facets of the world, the artistic and cultural world, came through 30th Street at one time or another. They did a series of poetry recordings with Catherine Ann Porter and Edna Ferber and Truman Capote and all these people that we're not touching. Did I see a hand over there? No.
How much time are you going to have in there?
I have an hour and a half, and I just spent 2.25 hours on it. So I got to figure that out.
We interrupted quite a bit.
Well, but I like that.
Interrupt?
I do. I do. I want people to interrupt. I get tired of hearing myself.
No. You want the interaction, right?
I want the interaction. And as you heard, you guys elaborated on what I was saying, which was wonderful. So thank you for that. So I got to cut some of that out, obviously. I'm in a scheduled slot. I'm on Saturday from 10:45 until 12:15 in their largest space. So I can't imagine how that's going to work. But that was the only choice for an hour and a half. They originally scheduled me for an hour. And I said, well, I really have a lot more material than an hour. Can I, anyway, well, the only time is this and that. So yeah. So we totally blew our intermission, and we've got some door prizes here that we should do. We've got a cookies. But we can't eat in the room.
Yeah.
Do you want to do the door prizes first?
Yeah, I can do that.
Let's do that first. So everybody who came, somebody came in late back there, and you need to fill out a form if you want one of our awesome door prizes. And
we've got a bunch.
With the top one,
in
my opinion, this is probably not true for anybody else. In my opinion, the top one is this book called New York by Don Hunstein, which is early photos of his. And I bought This came out in two editions with two different names, but it's the same book. And I bought two of them, so I have an extra one that I'm giving tonight. So this will be our last door prize. So please come and fill out a form. There, it has nothing about the 30th Street Studio, though. So be ready for that.
Dan?
Do we want to give out all of these?
No.
Okay. Why don't you pick
what...
Do we need a pee break first?
Yeah.
Or do you want to just do this and then you can take the pee break? Yeah, it's pretty late. I think we should do this and be done.
Do
you want to turn up the lights?
And then, yeah, lift up the bucket.
Rick, would you pick what you want to give out tonight? I'm not capable of doing that. Thank you again for all of this. This is really awesome.